and Tom and Lara are together in a taxi. Chapter 3. Monday morning. I'm immersed in Excel spreadsheets, surveying the health, or lack thereof, of my company, when Gordon Farrell rings. The pleasantries don't take long, but he is pleasant and genuine. A decent man. Even without Tom's damning account of Caro's mother, if Caro is the average of Gordon and his ex-wife, I have no desire to meet the ex-wife. "So who's on your list, Kate?" asks Gordon. "We've moved on to first-name terms." He means who would I target for the open positions at his firm. I've been prepping for exactly this question, only I'm a little thrown to be answering it on the phone on Monday rather than a lunch on Tuesday. Still, I move smoothly into my "here's one I prepared earlier" answer, and we bat back and forth on that for a few minutes. Paul enters the office we share as I'm talking, loosening his silk tie as he sinks into the chair behind his desk. His blonde eyebrows, so pale as to be not worth having, rise as he listens to my half of the conversation while drinking his takeout coffee. "Hafton Wile," he mouths. I nod. Then my attention is fully caught by Gordon's next comment, stated with such deliberate casualness that it's clear this is what he's been waiting to talk about all along. "You haven't mentioned Dominic Burns." "Not Dominic," I say instantly. It's an instinctive response. I should have prevaricated. I should have given myself time to find out if Gordon is hell-bent on hiring this man. But it's too late for that now. Across the room, Paul is choking on his coffee. "Why not Dominic?" asks Gordon diffidently. "He's a prime candidate with his experience. And I hear he's looking to move. He wants to head up a meaningful business area with the right support to really make a dent into private equity clients." "Do you have any plans to retire, Gordon?" I ask. "In the next, say, 5 years?" Paul's eyes almost pop out. He makes urgent gestures. "I'm not following you," says Gordon after a moment. "Dominic Burns doesn't want a job heading up a business area. He wants your job, managing partner."
"He doesn't have that kind of experience," Gordon objects.
"Not yet, but he's aggressively ambitious, and after a couple of years at Hafton Wile, he'll start to feel he deserves a shot, which is fine if you're looking for someone to hand the reins to, but if not, he'll go looking for a firm where he can get the opportunity he really wants. You'll have him in place for 3 years, tops." Paul is standing now in obvious agitation. His frantic hand-waving may be interpreted as ordering me to stop talking or to immediately slit my throat. I ignore him and continue. "When he jumps ship, he'll take all your lovely new clients with him, and probably a host of your up-and-coming juniors, too." I give Paul a one-fingered gesture of my own, which isn't open to any misinterpretation, then spin my chair to face away. I like Gordon. I don't want to see him make the wrong hire. "And you'll be back at square one." There's silence down the phone line for a long moment. Then Gordon says,
"You sound like you know him well."
"I do, actually. I worked under him for a while at Clifford Chance."
"Interesting. Well, that's certainly food for thought, Kate."
I put down the phone and spin round to find Paul looming over my desk, almost incoherent with frustration.
"What are you doing?" he groans, one hand clutching his head. "The first rule of service industries, give the client what they want. The man wants to hire Dominic Burns, so tell him you'll get him Dominic Burns. It's a no-brainer."
"It's the wrong hire," I argue. "He needs to know that."
"No, he doesn't. He needs to hire him and pay us a whacking great check."
I can't deny a whacking great check would be helpful. Paul sees my weakness and presses on.
"Kate, we need this, and you've just blown it. Why the hell would you torpedo it? If he's got his mind set on someone, then we get them. It's as simple as that." He'll respect us more for giving him honest, open feedback.
I fire back, stung by his blown-it comment. Though, of course, he may be right.
We don't need this so badly that I'm going to forget how to do a good job.
If we don't get a big contract soon, you won't be doing any job.
He lets out a long breath.
We're fine.
I spin the computer screen to show him what I've been looking at. He perches on the desk and leans in to run his eye down the figures.
See? The small stuff is going to tide us over. We've got time, and we're obviously building a name or Hafton Weil wouldn't even be talking to us.
The small stuff keeps the lights on and the printer running, he says dismally. It doesn't, you know, pay us, which I've got to say, I'm quite attached to as a concept.
He runs a hand through his hair. I realize he looks tired. It doesn't sit well on his fair skin.
I don't think I'm going to learn the Freshfields guy.
Ah.
Ah, indeed.
He sighs and climbs off the edge of the desk, then turns back to me.
Haft and Weil are going to cancel the lunch, you know.
They won't.
It's only dogged bravura that forces me to disagree with him. Nobody calls for an in-depth strategy session if they intend to keep a lunch date the following day.
You'll see, Paul says wearily.
That afternoon, Gordon Farrow's secretary calls me. Not to cancel, but to postpone due to
Mr. Farrow's travel commitments.
Paul wisely says nothing.
Monday evening finds me back at my flat unusually early for the appointment with Mr. Modane. Actually, Monsieur Alain Modane, Investigateur, OPJ, whatever that stands for. Basically, the French detective. He would have met me at my office if I'd preferred, but I'd rather Julie and Paul not know about this. Helping the police with their inquiries could end up sounding like a euphemism for something more sinister after a few Chinese whispers. And who wants to hire a legal recruiter that's in trouble with the law?
Thank you for seeing me, he says, as we settle into my living room.
It wasn't clear to me I had the option to refuse. I smile to lessen the sting. He is rummaging through his bag and looks up at my words, his long, intelligent face already pulled into a half-ironic smile. There are deep smile lines framing his mobile mouth, and a slim-fitting dark grey suit hangs on his too lanky, too thin frame. Somehow, the sum of the parts is an unexpectedly attractive man. I can't possibly imagine a British detective in the same mould.
There is always the option, no?
He says, his accent unmistakable.
Though I would not think it the wisest choice.
The smile flashes again. Then he returns to his bag. I watch as he finds his notepad and flicks through the pages.
Tea? Coffee?
I make the offer once the silence has grown uncomfortably long from my point of view. In truth, I want a glass of wine, but not one that comes with Modane's interrogation.
No, thank you, he says, without looking up.
Finally, he turns his dark eyes on me.
I'm sorry this is very inconvenient for you, but please, a few questions. You probably answered the same 10 years ago, but it's, how you say, procedure.
He spreads his hands wide, palms up, with a Gallic shrug, inviting me to sympathize.
Procedure, what can you do, eh?
It was a very long time ago, I say steadily. I doubt I can add anything. Probably the opposite. I expect I've forgotten so much that I'll confuse things for you.
He shrugs again. Well, let's see. Yes?
Yes, of course, go ahead. He's here now, in the country, and in my living room. Of course he's going to ask his questions. Of course I'll have to answer them. And all the time Severine will be waiting for her chance to appear. I had thought she would fade away after a few days, once I'd got over the shock. But no, Severine has more staying power than I anticipated.
Bon. So you left the farmhouse on Saturday the 16th, yes?
Yes.
All six of you?
Yes, all six of us. Six on the vacation. Really four plus two, but not the two I'd expected. I'd imagined it would be Seb and me, plus a selection of our friends. It turned out to be Lara and me, plus Seb and his friends.
You drove back to London?
I nod. In my car. We'd planned to use Seb's father's BMW, but there had been some problem. I can't remember what. The others had been extremely rude about my ancient little banger, until it turned out it was the only vehicle we could get hold of.
Ah, yes, in your...
He checks his notes.
Vauxhall Nova.
He checks again.
Really?
He looks at me doubtfully.
Six of you? That would be very... squished.
Four of us. Theo and Tom took the train back together. I dropped them at the station that morning, then went back for the others.
Ah, Theo.
He pronounces it the French way. Theo.
Afghanistan, yes?
Very sad. His long face does indeed hold sympathy, whether genuine or not, I can't tell. I expect he's very good at his job. Yes. Very sad. It is sad, and senseless, and a waste, and a whole lot of other things I can't possibly put into words. But even if I could, it wouldn't change the outcome. Theo is dead.
He was very patriotic?
I'm sorry?
He loved his country very much. He always wanted to be a soldier, to fight for her.
I rub my forehead. No, I don't think... We were all quite surprised when he enlisted. Theo hadn't seemed the type. Too nervous, too self-conscious. The army seemed to me like a grown-up version of a boys' boarding school. Theo had hated boarding school. I shake my head abruptly. I'm sorry, what has this got to do with... He puts out a placating palm. The man has an elegant gesture for everything.
Forgive me, forgive me. We must return to the point. What time did you leave the farmhouse?
I try to remember. I must have dropped Theo and Tom at the train station before 9, I think. The rest of us had planned to be on the road by 9:30, but Caro wasn't ready. One more reason to be furious with Caro, not that I needed another reason that morning, after the revelations of the previous night. Perhaps 10:30? He nods and makes a note.
Were you the driver?
Yes, I was the only one insured.
You drove all the way back? You didn't share?
His surprise is clear. I remember the journey, although I don't want to. The car lacked air conditioning. I was hot and tired and tight-lipped with hurt and resentment. Caro sat in the back, uncharacteristically pale and quiet. I wondered if she was suffering in the aftermath of the drugs, and thought savagely that it would serve her right. Lara was golden and sleek, full of cat-like satisfaction, after a few days of frolicking with Tom. She slept almost all the way. And Seb... I don't want to think about Seb. I swallow. Like I said, I was the only one insured. His lips twist and he makes another note.
Bon. So a Vauxhall Nova. Were there any other automobiles at the property?
No, we just used my car. My mobile rings. Lara. Sorry, I say, quickly turning it off. I can call her later. I want to get this over with.
You're sure? Nothing in the garage?
Well, there was an old Jag that belonged to Theo's father, but we never touched it. No one was allowed to drive it. The farmhouse belonged to Theo's parents back then. They sold it later, after Theo died. He is nodding. He obviously knows about the Jaguar.
Did you see Miss Dupar on the morning of the departure?
No. I can feel my muscles tensing.
as if anticipating an impact.
The day before, perhaps?
Yes. My answers are brief, clipped.
Was that habitual?
The word choice is odd. Perhaps he has translated directly from the French.
Did she pass much time with you during the week?
I nod again. He assesses me with his dark eyes and sits silently, waiting for more. I sigh. Monosyllabic responses are not going to get me through this interview. Theo's family and hers were on quite friendly terms. Both families had been spending most of the summer down there for years. Severine's parents' place didn't have a pool, but Theo's parents let them use theirs whenever they wanted. Severine has appeared, swept in on the flow of words. She's facing away from me on the steps of the pool in a black bikini, knee-deep in the cool water, her narrow back perfectly straight. Seb, Lara, Caro and I have just arrived, and Theo, who arrived earlier, is showing us round. The unexpected sight of a girl in the pool draws us all up short.
Severine! Exclaims Theo, bounding toward her. I didn't expect to see you.
She turns her head and regards us all, then climbs out of the pool to treble kiss him hello, apparently completely unself-conscious despite her scant attire. I find it hard to look away. The narrowness of her hips is a marvel. Her belly is flat yet soft like a child's. Her shoulders and arms shimmer with the sheen of sunscreen.
Dale, she says solemnly, her English heavily accented. I did not know I would be here either.
She looks at the rest of us, weighing and measuring.
I am Severine, she says. The mademoiselle next door.
You saw her every day?
Asks Alain Modan. I'm grateful for the question. It dissolves Severine's presence.
Yes, she would come to the pool, and often she would eat dinner with us.
He nods.
How was she?
I look at him blankly. He snaps his fingers repeatedly, frustrated with himself as he tries to find the right words.
Emotions, temperament. How was she?
Well, she was... I stop, trying to find the right words myself. She was a very self-contained girl. If there was anything bothering her, I wouldn't have known.
Was she closer to one than another? Perhaps she spent more time with Theo since they already knew each other.
No, not Theo. He looks up sharply from his notebook at my tone and raises his eyebrows. I mean, not with anyone specifically, I add quickly. His eyebrows have not quite descended fully, and his eyes remain on me. I work hard to hold his gaze, and I don't think of Seb. After a moment he gives a minute shrug and looks at his notebook again.
Did she speak about her plans for after she left the Dordogne?
Not with me. Though Caro said that she told Theo she was heading back to Paris. He cocks his head to one side.
Caroline Orridge? She said that?
I nod. The other night. He is making notes again in his little book. His handwriting is like tiny spiders multiplying across the page.
So, the well. There was... How do you say, workings going on?
Building works. It's a relief to move on to something less personal. Theo's parents wanted to rent the place out. They needed a few things done to comply with the safety regulations.
Modan is nodding. Oui, a fence all around the pool and the well filled in.
Probably, I shrug. I remember the builders doing the pool fence. Suddenly the significance of what he's saying hits me.
Oh, the well. She... God, she must have been in there before they filled the well.
The skull appears, but it's no longer gleaming. Sand fills the eye sockets and spills out of the grinning mouth. I find my hand is at my mouth, and carefully remove it to descend to my lap. Is that why you didn't find her? I mean, till now?
We didn't find her because we were looking in the wrong place, he says simply.
His eyes are fixed on me again. I can't fathom his expression. Do you think it was her boyfriend? Ex-boyfriend, I mean.
We are looking at all possibilities.
Yes, but you must be looking pretty hard at him in particular, I say impatiently, suddenly fed up with the one-sided nature of this interview, even though that's how interviews are meant to be. There was a history, right? Severine said she'd had to call the police about him before.
There's no record of that.
He's looking at me as if he's waiting for something. I pause. No record. Severine lied. Why would she lie about that? But I instantly know the answer. To appear more mysterious, more alluring. The kind of woman a man would literally go insane for.
None, says Alain Modan calmly. And the ex-boyfriend, he was doing a science project. Some very intense work for his thesis. He was in the laboratory every day in June, even weekends, attending to his cultures or some such.
His hand waves expressively. So? He is still watching, waiting for me to catch on to something. I shake my head dumbly. He tries again.
So unless the well was not filled in until July?
The doorbell buzzes, cutting him off. He cocks his head questioningly at me. I shrug, then raise myself up from the sofa to go and answer, and find that I'm stiff. I've been sitting unnaturally still for a very long time now. I know it's Lara before I open up. I can hear her rustling in her bag for the spare key she keeps. Lara, the detective, is here, I say quickly as I unlatch the door, forestalling her greeting. She looks past me, alarmed, as if she can see through the hall walls to the living room.
I thought that was tomorrow, she whispers urgently.
No, today. You may as well come and say hello.
But I don't, I'm not, but...
I look at her puzzled. Then she takes a deep breath and smooths her dress.
Okay.
She comes in, taking a quick glance at herself in the hallway mirror, before she follows me into the living room. Mr. Modan has climbed to his feet and is looking out of the window. He turns as he hears us enter the room, and his face goes oddly still. Before I have a chance to say a few words of polite introduction, Lara speaks up from behind me.
It's you.
I glance at her, not understanding the words or her tone. Her cheeks are flushed, and she's half turned to the door, as if she still might flee. The French investigator could be a statue. I'm not completely sure he's breathing. Then, with an effort, he comes alive and shoots the cuffs of his suit before crossing the room to shake her hand.
Yes. Alain Modan.
Lara Peterson, she says quietly. But of course you know that. I look from one to the other.
I wonder if it will be the same one.
She wasn't talking about the lead investigator.
I take it I've been very rude and fail to remember you from the earlier investigation, I say dryly to Alain Modan.
He turns to me with a quick smile and raises a hand as if to say, no matter.
It was a long time ago. I was very junior, one of many assisting.
He looks back at Lara, then away quickly. Then he collects himself.
Miss Channing, you have a guess. We can continue another time, if I have more questions.
Oh, okay, fine. If I'd known having a guest would roust him, I'd have arranged for an interruption long before this, I think sourly. Except I wouldn't have, really. Better to get these things over and done with. He turns to Lara.
À demain, Miss Peterson.
Until tomorrow.
Oui, à demain, she says, then follows up with something too quick for me to catch. I forgot Lara's French was rather impressive. She's one of those irritating Scandinavians with umpteen languages to their credit. When I've closed the door on Monsieur Alain Modane, investigateur, I follow Lara to the kitchen and find her already pulling a bottle of white wine from my fridge and studiously avoiding my eye. What was that all about? She pours two glasses, very large glasses. She seems to be giving the task more attention than it deserves.
Nothing. What do you mean?
Don't give me that.
Did you and he?
No. She looks up, appalled.
Of course not.
I hold her gaze until she breaks and takes a sip of her wine. I reach out for my own glass and take a sip, still watching her. She's avoiding my eyes again.
Lara,
I say warningly.
Oh, all right.
She folds, like I knew she would, and finally looks up.
Nothing happened, truly.
She takes another sip of wine, then says in a rush,
he wouldn't. He said it wouldn't be proper, appropriate, I mean, under the circumstances.
She's blushing, more furiously than I've ever seen before.
Oh, my God,
I say wonderingly, a smile breaking out slowly on my face.
He's that mythical creature, the one that got away from Lara Peterson.
He's not, it's not,
oh, fuck off,
she says, screwing up her nose prettily. She takes an unfeasibly long drink from her glass, then looks at me dejectedly.
Only it's still not appropriate, right?
Not until he clears us from the investigation. And then he'll be back in France.
I can't believe you never told me any of this.
I'm not hurt. I'm just amazed that I missed this. She ducks her head apologetically.
Well, like I said, nothing happened. And you and Seb had just split up, and you know what a state that left you in. I didn't want to dump my crap on you.
For once, the mention of Seb slides by almost unnoticed. I'm too thrown by this revelation. What else did I miss when I was licking my Seb-inflicted wounds? She takes in another large slug of wine, and I gaze at her in bemusement. Not only did the rejection matter to her then, it clearly still matters now. This is a Lara I haven't seen before. And then I think, poor Tom. Chapter 4. I dream of Severine, among others. She has no right to be in my dreams, but that would never have stopped Severine. I'm back at the farmhouse, of course, and I'm trying to find something, or someone. But what? Who? I stick my head in the rooms, some empty, some not. Some of the occupants weren't even part of that fateful vacation. But somehow I'm not surprised to see them. I keep looking. Caro is alone in the kitchen. She's wearing a white bikini top and a red chiffon sarong, and she looks up, then laughs at me when I pass through. I realize I'm clad in jeans and a heavy-duty winter jumper, but I know I've nothing else to wear. Severine is smoking in the garden. She tells me something very seriously, but I don't listen. In fact, I'm picking up speed, running to the barn. The jumper is uncomfortably hot. I throw open the barn door, then catch my breath when I find Seb there. He's wearing long beach shorts that are slung low on his hips. His hair is lighter than Tom's, almost golden at the tips, and curlier. His muscular bare chest is tanned, and dark springy hair makes a trail down his abdomen. A fully-fledged man, whereas his peers are still leaving boyhood. Just like Caro, he looks me up and down with those blue eyes that could be Tom's, then laughs. It's not a kind laugh. The dream doesn't fade when I wake. It presses on my temples and adds to the throbbing left by one too many glasses of wine with Lara. Getting out of bed, in fact, all of what the day requires, seems a supreme effort. but then I imagine Paul and Julie at the office wondering where I am, and that provides the necessary impetus. By the time Tom calls my mobile that afternoon, the headache has dulled, but the effort remains.
"How was it?"
he asks. I can hear a very particular hubbub in the background, sharp orders and staccato words in the mail register. He's on the trading floor at his bank. Tom trades interest rate derivatives. I'm on Oxford Street myself, en route to meet a prospective client. I expect my own background noise is equally loud.
"How was what? Please tell me you're not rigging the markets while chatting to me."
He laughs. "No, I have people to do that for me now. And for the benefit of the recorded line, that was a joke. Anyway, I meant, how was the thing with the French detective?"
"Pretty awful, actually."
I look around, then back at the map in my hand. New Bond Street is a big street. It can't have disappeared.
"How so?" he asks cautiously.
"It's... well, I don't really want to think about what might have happened to her. I don't really want to think about her at all." I look around again. There's a disappointing lack of street name signs. "Jesus, where is this place?" I mutter. I spy something that might be a sign and march in that direction.
"Lost?" asks Tom, amused. "Where's your legendary sense of direction?"
"Lara drowned it in wine last night. It's her turn with the detective today, actually."
"Yeah, I know, I spoke to her this morning," he says easily.
I stop walking. Lara must have given him her number.
"It's tomorrow for me. Listen, I have to jump. I've got a dicey option expiry approaching, but I was wondering if you fancy coming down to Hampshire for Sunday lunch. My folks would love to see you."
Sure. I don't think I have anything on. Sounds lovely."
Which it does. I've met his parents half a dozen times over the years, though never at their home. His dad is charmingly eccentric, and his mum is lovely.
"Is Lara coming too? Oh, she's in Sweden this weekend, I forgot."
"Yeah, she's away."
He already knows what her weekend plans are.
"I'll drive us down. I'll call you on Saturday to figure out timings."
I hear someone calling his name in the background.
"Yeah, just coming,"
he calls back. Then to me, "Speak Saturday."
"Saturday."
I pocket my phone and look around again. New Bond Street is right there, where it's always been. I still have a headache. Sunday. Tom turns up at 10:30 in something retro, white, and low-slung that he's visibly excited by. Cars mean nothing to me, but Seb would be envious, I think. Then I shut down that train of thought.
"Am I supposed to be in awe?" I ask Tom teasingly.
"The salesman promised me the mere sight would make women drop their knickers," he deadpans.
"I would, but it's a bit chilly today, and I don't fancy a draft up my skirt."
I walk around the car. Even to the uninitiated, it's a very cool car.
"How old is it?"
"Considerably older than both of us. It's a Toyota 2000 GT. Well, mostly. Some of the parts have been replaced, which reduces the value."
The sun makes a brief appearance, bouncing off the immaculate white paintwork.
"I picked it up this morning." He can't keep the smile off his face as he talks. It's infectious. He reaches out a long arm and opens the passenger door, waggling his eyebrows suggestively.
"Can I take you for a ride, Miss Channing?"
I laugh and fold myself into the seat. "I thought you'd never ask." The seat is uncomfortable and the heating intermittent, but the sun comes out and stares out. That, and the car, and Tom's mood have me giddy for the first half hour, which carries us through the London traffic. When the roads open up and the car settles into a steady thrum through increasingly green countryside, our chatter tails off into comfortable silence.
"Do you want some music?" asks Tom, glancing across at me.
His lips are tugging upward at the corners. I wait for the punchline.
"'Cause if so, you'd better start singing. The radio doesn't work."
Will you get one fitted?
He shrugs.
I don't know. It would reduce the value, but I didn't buy this purely as an investment, otherwise I wouldn't even be driving it.
His eyes crinkle at the corners.
I've always wanted this car.
A psychologist would have a field day with that, given the timing and all.
They'd probably be right to, he admits with a sheepish grin. I'm basically driving the deposit I'd saved for a house with Jenna.
I can't help laughing. He doesn't join in, but he's grinning.
You've been lucky settling back into London, I comment. Back in your old flat, back on your old desk at work, except a few rungs up the ladder. Did you think about staying in Boston?
He shakes his head.
Boston is a great city, but I never felt settled there. Maybe it was my fault. I didn't properly commit to staying long term. Once Jenna and I split up, there was nothing to keep me there.
The sun is streaming directly through the windscreen. He finds some sunglasses and puts them on one-handed, with remarkable dexterity.
What about you? What made you go out on your own? Starting your own business in this climate can't be easy. I don't remember you even mentioning the idea when you came out to Boston.
I close my eyes and rest my head back against the seat, feeling the sun soak into my face.
Oh, you know me, I say airily. I'm basically unemployable.
Rubbish. You have a first from Oxford and the best CV of anyone we know.
Slight exaggeration, but anyway, I didn't say I was unhirable. I'm unemployable, as in unsuitable for employment.
My eyes are still closed.
Ah, he says, understanding. You mean much better suited to being the employer.
Exactly. I open my eyes and turn my head, still resting on the headrest, to look at him. I can't see his eyes through the sunglasses, but I know what they look like.
Seb doesn't freckle, though.
I got fed up of being overlooked in favour of inferior lawyers who had the right accent and went to the right school.
I grimace.
I may have been vocal about it from time to time.
How can you spot a balanced northerner? Asks Tom.
He goes on before I can answer. They have a chip on both their shoulders.
He's teasing me, but I know he understands, at least in part.
Tom's whole upbringing has put him on the outside, looking in. Looking in on Seb, whose father is some kind of nobility, a marquis or a baron or an earl, I forget exactly what. With the stately home and vast grounds, one might expect along with such a title. Tom grew up in a cottage on the estate, gifted by the earl or marquis or baron to his little sister, Tom's mother, when she married a penniless academic. Anyway, one day one of the partners told me I was the best candidate for partner he'd ever come across, but if I couldn't learn to shut my mouth and put up with some crap from time to time, there was no way I'd even make the shortlist. I'd be turfed out.
What did you say to that? Tom asks.
Not much at the time. I was too furious to say anything at all, really. But then I thought about it, and he was right. There's no way they could make me partner the way I was. It would be like putting itching powder on everyone's skin.
And you didn't want to change?
I could have changed. Well, maybe. But not for that firm. Too traditional, too old school. It got me thinking about how important it is to get the right fit when you hire someone. I mean, they should never have hired me in the first place.
I expect they were trying to fill some diversity quota. Female, went to a state school.
Tom remains quiet. I close my eyes again and turn my face to the sun. The thrum of the car is soporific. Time becomes elastic. I have no idea how much is passing.
You never told me much about your meeting with the detective, I hear Tom say.
I open my eyes again reluctantly. I don't want Severine to intrude today. She doesn't belong in the sunshine.
Not much to tell. He just went over the timings of when we left, really.
Nothing else? He asks casually.
No, I say, bemused.
I think back to the meeting. It doesn't seem my place to tell him about Lara's fascination with the detective. Though perhaps I should if Tom is going to get hurt.
What?
Asks Tom, noticing my hesitation.
Nothing.
I grope around for something to cover with.
Just, well, he said he didn't think it was the boyfriend.
Tom is nodding.
Yeah, Theo's dad told me he's out of the picture.
Mordan was a bit more conditional than that. It seems to hinge on the timing of when the well was filled in, I think. I frown. But surely they know when that was done.
Tom shakes his head and says carefully, There's some confusion.
He appears to be intent on the road. With his sunglasses on, I can't read his expression at all.
How come? Can't they check with the builders?
I can see the two builders in my head, both in their 30s, unmistakably brothers, with the same swarthy complexion, dark hair and heavy eyebrows. I remember watching them watch us. I remember the resentment in their eyes, and the sense of unease it put in me. I could see us from their perspective, the careless, awful presumptions of privilege. I wanted to say, but I'm not one of them. Only I was, at least for that week.
Haven't tracked them down again yet.
But according to the records that the police looked at then, the well was filled in on the Friday. He glances across at me. Oddly, I have the same feeling as with the detective. He's watching me, waiting for something. I shake my head dumbly. He elaborates.
Friday, Kate. The day before we left.
But that's impossible. I'm no longer sleepy. Severine was with us on Friday night.
I know that. You know that.
He shrugs. I am upright in my seat now, twisted sideways to stare at Tom's profile. He's calmly focusing on the road ahead.
There's CCTV footage of Severine at the bus depot on Saturday morning,
I argue heatedly.
And the bus driver remembered her getting on at the stop by the farmhouse. So she obviously wasn't, you know, stuffed in a well at that point.
The skull is there, with the dirt and the sand and the insects. I shake my head violently. It doesn't dislodge.
I know, I know.
Tom takes a hand off the wheel and spreads it out, palm up.
I'm just saying there are inconsistencies. Things like that, they muddy the waters, which could be rather inconvenient for us until it's all sorted out.
I'm still staring at him. He turns his head and takes in my expression.
Kate, he says gently, it's going to be fine. I just wanted to bring you up to speed. It will all be fine.
He smiles in what's meant to be a reassuring manner, but I can't see his eyes behind those sunglasses. Lunch is a pleasure, or should be a pleasure, but I can't shake a sense of unease. It flows beneath every conversation and fills every silence. Tom's parents don't notice. His mother is glowing to have her son at home again, however temporarily, and his dad's gruff welcome belied the delight in his eyes. But Tom's gaze rests on me frequently. I can't read what his eyes hold, which only adds to my unease. Tom's dad has a heavy hand with the wine. By dessert, I'm surreptitiously drinking as much water as possible in mitigation.
How is your mum, Kate?
Asks Tom's mother kindly.
Do you get up north to see her much?
She's well, thanks. Tom's mum has her head cocked on one side, listening to me sympathetically. I can see Tom in her. It makes me more open than I might otherwise be, that or the wine. She seems happy. She remarried last year. I guess I don't go up now as much as I used to.
You don't get on with her new husband?
I shake my head.
No, he's fine.
I hear my words and correct them. He's nice, actually. Dad's been gone a long time. Almost 10 years. I got the news only weeks after Seb and I broke up. It's great to think that she's not on her own anymore. But it's just different, I guess. Both Tom and his mother are looking at me. I duck my head and take a swallow of wine. After lunch, Tom's parents won't hear of us helping with the clearing up. Instead, they shoo us out to walk off our overindulgence on the estate grounds. We climb a small ridge and are suddenly presented with an uninterrupted view across a lawn to the main house. Seb's house. Well, his father's house. "You would think," I say, stopping to stare at the enormous white-painted building. It's from the Regency era, I seem to recall. There are columns and wings and more windows than I could reliably count. I start again. "You would think I would have been here." I look at Tom. He isn't meeting my eye. "Don't you think?" I challenge him. "Wouldn't you think that if you went out with someone for a year, you might see where they live when they're not at college?" Tom doesn't answer. I persist. "Wouldn't you think that?" "I don't think it was intentional," Tom hedges. "He didn't deliberately not invite you." "Maybe." I find a large rock to sit on. I've had too much to drink. I think of Caro in France.
"Of course, you've met Lord Harcourt, haven't you?"
"Such a dear." Her sharp eyes watching me, bird-like, readying to swoop in on any tidbits I give away.
"You haven't? Really?"
"Then again, maybe not." Tom runs a hand through his hair and sighs. "Look, Seb's relationship with his father is complicated. I'm sure the lack of invitation had nothing to do with you, and everything to do with that." "Maybe," I repeat. I lean down to pick up some earth and watch it dribble through my fingers. "Maybe not." "It's been 10 years, Kate," Tom says. The hard note in his voice snaps my head up to look at him. "When are you going to get over it?" I look away. I can't speak. We don't do this, Tom and I. We don't bring up this particular elephant in the room. We can be friends provided we skirt round the edges. I must be drunk to have violated that. I don't think he has the same excuse given he's driving. Suddenly Tom is hunkered down in front of me. "Kate, I'm sorry." He reaches out a hand to turn my face to him. His eyes are unhappy and his mouth is twisted in remorse. "Oh Christ, please don't cry. I didn't mean... It's just... I'm sorry." I take a shaky breath, then meet his eyes briefly and attempt to smile. "Me too. I think I'm what's known as tired and emotional."
"Come on, you."
He stands up and pulls me gently to my feet. "Let's get you home." My face feels cold where his hand has been. He threads my arm through his, and we walk back to the cottage in companionable silence. In the car on the way home, I can't fight the thrum of the engine and the alcohol in my system. I fall asleep. I wake slowly with a memory or a dream of someone stroking my cheek. Tom is grinning at me affectionately. The day of sunshine has brought out some of his freckles. "Wakey, wakey, sleeping beauty," he says. For a moment I'm displaced. The world hasn't yet dropped into position around me. For a moment, Tom is just Tom, and I'm just Kate, without any past or future, without any context. Then everything rushes back. Chapter 5. On Monday morning, Gordon Farrow's secretary calls to resurrect our lunch for 2 days hence. I would crow over Paul, except I've lost all faith. In any case, Paul looks like he can't take another cycle of hope-raising and dashing. A small contract he was counting on, that we were both counting on, has fallen through. His trenchant defeatism curls around him like a fog. Being near him brings a chill, I haven't known him long enough to estimate how long this will last. At this rate, I may not keep him long enough to find out. I return again and again to the financial spreadsheet that holds my future in its tiny white cells. The entries don't change. Even lunch with Lara fails as a tonic. We meet at a cafe halfway between our offices. Uncharacteristically, she's beaten me there. There's a glass of wine in front of her with a lipstick mark on it. I nod my head toward it after we kiss our hellos. Taking the rest of the day off? Lara can't function professionally after the merest sniff of alcohol. She has few rules, but no lunchtime drinking is one of them. She shakes her head. I'll be there in body, if not in mind. She takes a sip of the wine, then puts the glass down, then picks it up again. Anyway, shall we order? She puts the glass back down. Sure. We nab the waitress and order our usuals. Then I sit back and look at Lara. Is everything okay? Sure, of course. She smiles brightly, but it doesn't reach her eyes. And her eyes don't reach mine. How was Sweden?
Same old. Mum has a new man.
How is he?
Very Swedish, she says wryly. Bearded, friendly, earnest. But kind of sweet.
Finally I see her eyes. They're jittering around, as if it hurts to settle her focus.
Anyway, how was your weekend? Did you have fun with Tom?
Yeah, it was lovely, I say out of habit. Then wonder if that's accurate. It was lovely on the surface, but I have a sense of something lurking underneath. Or maybe my paranoia over the possibility of Paul jumping ship is bleeding into the rest of my life. I mentally shake myself and look at Lara's eyes again.
Geez, Lara, did you spend the weekend taking drugs or something?
Of course not, she exclaims, scandalized.
Then what's with you?
Nothing, except I think I had one too many Red Bulls this morning, she confesses, propping up her temple with the heel of one palm. You wouldn't believe how my heart has been racing. She gestures at the glass of wine.
Alcohol's a depressant, isn't it? I thought it might counteract the caffeine.
Honey, alcohol is just fanning the flames. It would be funny, except Lara doesn't look like she's having any fun. She looks almost feverish.
Let me put that glass aside. Here, have my water instead. Why the caffeine overdose, anyway?
She takes a long drink of the water and shrugs.
My flight was delayed, so I was late to bed, and then I couldn't get to sleep for ages.
She pauses. I wait. There's more to come. Whatever it is, she's half defensive about it. I'm not sure what the other half of her is feeling.
I bumped into Alan at the airport.
Her eyes flit to mine, then away.
Alan. Not Monsieur Modan, or the French detective.
How very coincidental, I say evenly.
Had you told him what flight you were on?
No, it was just a chance meeting. He was on his way back from spending the weekend in the south of France.
She takes in my expression and puts her hand on my arm, leaning forward entreatingly.
Come on, you have to admit it really could be a coincidence.
It could, I say non-contentiously, but I doubt it.
What did you talk about?
She blushes.
You know.
I don't, actually. I shake my head questioningly.
We just talked. Nothing happened, really.
Really? Now I'm wondering what did happen. Her hand is still on my arm, her eyes urgent. I nod, though I still don't understand. The nod is enough to allow the words to flood out of her.
I know we ought not, with the investigation and everything, but it's not like the six of us had anything to do with that. Alan and I. Well, we just talked about what we might do when this is all over.
What we would like to do. Her expression is begging me to understand. I shake my head minutely. I don't.
You know.
to do to each other? I stare at her open-mouthed. She's squirming, but her eyes are bright with excitement. It's not the caffeine overdose that's making her feverish. She's the girl with a secret that's just bursting to tell. Jesus, Lara has been talking dirty with the French detective. I rediscover my voice. All this in, what, the baggage reclaim lounge? Of course not. We grabbed a drink in the bar. Ah. I don't know how to convey the alarm bells that are ringing in my mind. Lara is never this excited over a man, ever. I suspect she won't take it kindly if I steal the wind from her sails, but this... I don't know what this is exactly, but I do know it's not a good idea. I struggle to find a casual tone. Did he ask about Severine? She nods. A bit. Well, not so much Severine, more about that week in general, you know, about all of us, how we met, who was with who, that sort of thing. It wasn't like an interview, it was just idle chat. Of course, idle chat. In between the virtual sex, that is. Kate, she giggles, she's actually giddy. It wasn't like that. Uh-huh. Idle chat about a murder case. I think of Alain Mordan. I imagine his active brain working away behind those dark, ironic eyes, scurrying like a rat in a maze to explore all potential avenues. Tom's words float back to me. There are inconsistencies. Things like that, they muddy the waters. Did he tell you they're looking into when the well was filled in? She nods. He mentioned that. I suppose they have to tick every box, but it seems a waste of effort since it was obviously after we left. But they have to do it. Apparently they even have to try and pin down exactly which ferry we were on, so they have confirmation of when we left the farmhouse. It's really hard work for him, she says earnestly, then looks up as the waitress arrives with our plates. Oh, thank you. I start eating mechanically, my mind full of Monsieur Mordan, and Tom's words, and Severine. Always Severine, with her walnut skin and secretive eyes hovering just out of sight. Why is he even back in the UK? I ask suddenly. What? Lara looks up from her salad. Mordan, I thought he interviewed us all. Why is he still here? Oh, yeah, he said he had a few more questions. For who? For whom? She corrects, with a glimmer of a smile. Lara prides herself on having better English than any native-born. Actually, for you, I think. She shrugs. Probably my fault, I suppose. After all, I did interrupt your session with him. Another interview. I reach for the wine glass. And for Seb, of course, she adds, with an apologetic grimace. Apparently he'll be back in the country this week. She goes on, hesitantly. Are you okay with that? Seb being back, I mean. I dare say I'll cope. It comes out harsher than intended. Lara flinches. I'm instantly remorseful. I'm sorry, honey. I don't mean to snap. I'm just having a shitty week. She nods sympathetically, accepting the apology. I feel guilty enough to consider her question more carefully. I actually don't know what I feel. I suppose I spent so long avoiding thinking about him that I'm not sure what I think anymore. She cocks her head. So maybe it would be good for you to see him. Maybe. I take a swallow of the wine. But in an ideal world, not in a week when my business is going under and I'm being interviewed in connection with a murder. She laughs. Come on, that's a little dramatic. We're just helping the investigation. We're not really suspects. Well, that depends. What do you mean? That depends on when the well was filled in, or at least when the police think the well was filled in. She stares at me. Her eyes have finally found their focus. You really think?
but he hasn't said anything.
She trails off.